territory. There ain't nobody out there gonna mess with me. 'Cause I'm big and hard and battle-scarred and getting long in the tooth. Desperate and hungry and got nothing to lose. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf. I've been chased, I've been bit. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf. They like to shoot me, but they don't. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf. And I ain't never been trapped. And I have the people, the things that got me cornered at last. I've been tracking, I've been running since I was 3. Born in Louisiana swamp, moved with the pack to Tennessee. Raised by black and white dogs to some country, some rock and roll. It's good now, boy, you don't have to quit your howling song. I'm all night, shaking lightly by the moon. Laying up all day on the porch, playing guitar tunes. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf. I know I'm with the fact. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf. I don't ever look back. Yeah, I'm a lone wolf. And I'll get it on the prowl.
Yeah, out on the prowl, I'm back in the bunker, boys and girls. Hey, the wild man is back. Terrible Tommy. I think I'm hitting that mic a little bit too hard. I tend to do that. I'll try to talk a little, I'll yell a little softer. This is Terrible Tommy, back from the road trip, and it's a misty London kind of foggy day here in Indiana, but we don't have any ice or snow. That's a good thing. It is January the 16th, 2017, and it's the birthday of Robert E. Lee today. Yeah, and it's also the holiday we celebrate most, and that is James Earl Ray Day. Yeah, I've heard there's other holiday, there's another holiday going on, but I haven't seen anybody talking about it much around here unless it's on radio and TV. I was surprised that my local bank did not close down today for the so-called holiday, but I said, you should have, it's Robert E. Lee's birthday. I was in there talking to him. They didn't know that. They didn't know that. Well, since he's lost the war at Gettysburg, I don't talk too much about Robert E. Lee. Yeah, that's right. If he had listened to Longstreet and the boys at Gettysburg, they would have won the war. Should have won the war anyhow. But that's history, that's showbiz. See, you got to learn that charging right up the middle really went out with the Britishers and the War of 1812 and like that. But they were still practicing that bullshit in the Civil War. A massive amount of men and just charge right up the middle and they just cut them to pieces. Cannons with chains coming out of them and everything else. So they could have learned one thing from the Indians, from the Mongols, how to fight, well, to win. Some people would say fight dirty. Bullshit. Hang from the trees. Hang from whatever. Get the job done. And the president of the Confederacy wanted to continue the war, guerrilla warfare. But Robert E. Lee said, no, I'm throwing in the towel. Too bad. Too bad. So I don't really celebrate Robert E. Lee Day. Plus, he was fighting for the wealthy, the upper class in the South. That's what the whole war was about anyhow. Them and their property, the Negroes. Yeah, and you know, most white people are saps when it comes to wars like that. They march off and get their ass blown off for the wrong reasons. Now, if they were fighting to protect their plot of land, their little farm, that's one thing. But in reality, they were fighting to save the oligarch's ass. The cotton magnets. And of course, if you don't know by now, I'll send you the stuff on it. The cotton industry screwed the South more than anything else. Let's face it, most of that cotton was going for middle class people in Britain and upper class people in Britain to wear nice dresses and stuff. The poor whites in this country that were working like slaves, they didn't get that much out of cotton. So, and it was a crop that ruined the land or took so much out of the land. And because cotton was the big deal and slaves were the big deal, the economic outlooks of the South went down the tube. Before the Civil War and before, Virginia had a GNP much higher than New York City. But as they brought more and more niggers in and planted more and more cotton, that kept the small farmers out like we're farming in the North. And so the GNP of the South went down, and so the GNP of the North got bigger and bigger and bigger. And of course, they could afford a bigger army and a lot more weapons when it came to the Confederacy. So, you see, we were screwed in World War II. We were screwed in Vietnam. We were screwed in Korea. It's all been a screw job on a white working man. And he's went run off to fight the wars for these fucking upper class, the ruling class. And he still keeps doing it. And whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, he's going to end up doing the same thing. Sorry, boys. Sorry. You know, most of the conservative right-wing radio now are more pro-black than a lot of the liberals. Not all the liberals are that liberal. But these guys that run these right-wing radio shows, they're kissing the ass the blacks more than ever. Well, they get uptight once in a while, and Rush Scumbaugh today was going after John Lewis. But they won't take the real gloves off. They'll not take the real gloves off. They'll use another excuse. And they'll go on and on and how they hate racism and so forth. Well, as far as I'm concerned, if you're not standing up and saying I'm a racial separatist, when people ask you, then you're not one of us. You gotta, unless you're in a sensitive position, a job that you can do us more good by being quiet. We've always promoted that kind of stuff. Anyhow, things around the country are pretty screwed. I've run into a lot of incompetence. I'll probably explain it to you someday. And it's unbelievable, even on small stuff, how incompetent the workforce is becoming. I mean, it's terrible, man. It's terrible. Let's see, I got a letter in here from Mahon. Mr. Mahon. It was all scrunched up and torn like the prison, somebody at the prison screwed with it. Dear Tom, I hope you and Mary are doing okay and are celebrating the Yule season and the winter solstice. Sorry it's been so long since I wrote last. It seems I've been very busy the last 2 months. The good news is that I have a very good chance to be transferred back to Illinois area from late February 17th to late March 17th. The Bureau of Prison Facilities I may get are FCI Terre Haute, Indiana. Whoa. FCI Greenville, Illinois. FCI Oxford, Wisconsin. FCR Martin, or possibly with a BOP waiver, PCI Pekin, Illinois. Well, that's going to be close to his family or his brother, and I bet you anything they won't send him to Pekin, because the prisons never want to make it nice for any prisoner. Thank you so much for the articles from the old Liberty Bell magazine by the late George Dietz. I received the great magazine from 1980 to, I believe, 93 or 94. Dan and I, in 89 or 90, drove from Revlo P. Oliver's home in central Illinois with about 300 of his great book, The Education of a Conservative. I think this was its title, to Reedy, West Virginia, to George's home. We stayed there 2 days. Beautiful country. We smoked a couple of George's great cigars and drank several bottles of his great home-brewed beer. Oliver's book was a good read. Dan and I really enjoyed Deese's stories about the Hitler Youth that he'd been in World War II. I sure enjoyed the articles you sent me from the Liberty Bell. Please enjoy the enclosed articles about the relationship that wolves have with ravens. Okay, that's a note there from Dennis Mahon. That book, The Education of a Conservative, I think was when a lot of us started moving away from the conservatives, as we could see they were escalating into oblivion. And I think that was a real good book by Revlo P. Oliver on the subject. I probably still got it in my library, but I'll have to dig for it. Here's a partial note from an inmate in the prison. Tom, greetings once again, writing with my utmost respects to war. Another guy has showed up claiming to be a war skin. And no, he has never heard of you. So I just shook his hand and laughed and walked away. Getting to be all these guys in prison saying that they're war skins and all that. Well, they're never. It was war skins only existed a few months. And then I cut off membership to that stuff. So ever since then, way back, nobody's been a card-carrying member to anything connected to me. If you're with me, you're with me. If you're not, you're not. That's simple as that. You don't need a card. You don't need a card, but they're in the, inside the prisons, they play games with names and so forth, saying they know all these guys that they don't know. They know guys that don't exist. They're war skins, but they don't know Tom Metzger. That reminds me of a time, I'll say the guy's name is George, but he used to be with me in the Klan. Turned out to be a big meth dealer. Bad news. Well, there was some skullduggery went down. Two murders went down of Klansmen. My Klansmen. But this guy got caught, and his co-conspirators got caught, and they got sent to prison. And one day this guy was in the middle of the courtyard where, you know, prisoners are let free to walk around. And he was carrying on bullshit about Tom Metzger. And he didn't know it, but he was surrounded by Tom Metzger people. And they just beat the shit out of the guy. That really happened. You don't pay to lie when people around you know better. It can get you in big trouble, and really big trouble if you're in prison. I was looking around my library for that book. It's called, I believe, The Making of an Assassin. And I'm going to have them send me another one because I think I've found one. But after reading that book, which didn't get that much publicity, I come to the conclusion that the Federals, CIA or whoever, the method they use when they want to get somebody and they don't want to be found out. Now remember, James Earl Ray's family, including Jerry Ray, his brother, had been in and out of problems for quite some time, low-level crime type thing. Not big stuff, but the whole family had been involved in it. Well, Jerry Ray was working for Edward Fields and J.B. Stoner at the Thunderbolt paper in Marietta, Georgia, and also involved in the National States Rights Party. It comes to me that it wouldn't be too much of a stretch for Jerry Ray to have been talking to his brother, and his brother might have mentioned how he wants to kill Martin Luther King, maybe on several occasions. Of course, most people blow that stuff off, you know. How many times have you heard people say crazy stuff? But on the other hand, I think the word got around that this guy might be serious. And the feds, of course, the CIA, they wanted Martin Luther King out of the way, not for any of the Negro crap, but because of the Vietnam War. And how he was massing people against the Vietnam War, which is fine with me. I agree. I agree a lot more now than I did way back. So they look around for potentials, get profiles. Well, obviously, due to James Earl Ray's movements around the country, which could have been suspicious or not, they decided to track him. So they tracked him around and tracked him around, and pretty soon they figured out this guy's a real deal. He's going after King. And so at that point, all they had to do was shadow James Earl Ray until the job was done, keeping local cops away from him while he prepared his deal. Remember, the cops there in the where the assassination was carried out were pulled back. There was a lot of strange things going on there. I think it was CIA intervening, or maybe FBI, pulling people back from interfering with James Earl Ray's job. So, if you'll read the last few pages where James Earl Ray's making a deal, it was simple. It was simple as duck soup. You could And so he bought himself the guns and so forth. And he pulled off the job. Now, that, see, the FBI, CIA, everybody has to go crazy and say, oh, that's horrible, it's horrible, it's this right-wing racist nut. Yeah. Well, I can give tribute to James Earl Ray for getting the job done, but not for the CIA in the background, which he probably never knew about, didn't have to know about. And that's what I figured this thing out on my own, which most people are going to say, oh, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. But I think it's logical. I did get some mail from James Earl Ray, but nothing along the lines of what I'm talking about. And, of course, you got to remember, he was, once he was institutionalized, he would say about anything to get off the hook. Well, there was no way he's going to get off the hook. Even dealing with the Martin Luther King family and all that, they didn't know squat. And he didn't know squat, actually, if it happened the way I think it did. He didn't know. It never came out. I think you'll find this happens a lot, to where the powers that be find themselves somebody that's a logical person to carry out an assassination or something, or a terrorist act. And they don't grab them, they just watch them, follow them around, and maybe even help guide them in the right direction until they pull off what they wanted them to pull off in the first place. And then the CIA or FBI or whoever, Homeland Security, can come roaring in, make arrests or shoot somebody, kill them, so there's no witness. I think that's a common practice of the system, and it's perfect. They did. I think they did it in the Kennedy assassination too. Think about it. Who could get away with setting that kind of stuff up? And what sure as hell wouldn't have been Lee Harvey Oswald. He just sort of stumbled into that thing. And of course, there's also the other evidence that the right hand man of Lyndon Johnson, who Johnson had got him off the hook for murder down in Texas, one of the most famous fingerprint people in the country. They found his fingerprint on the windowsill of the Texas depository. So there was an interesting connection that hardly anybody talks about. Now, what the hell was Lyndon Johnson's right-hand man, sort of his bodyguard and hitman, what was his print doing on the windowsill of that building? Think about it. Anyhow, what I'm telling you is most of these assassinations and terrorist thing are actually set up or encouraged behind the scenes by the system itself. A lot of you guys probably figured that out before me, but that's my story and I'm sticking to it. It's a perfect way to assassinate somebody, and they won't quit doing it because it works. They may have to follow dozens of people around that are not really serious about doing a job until they find one that is. And the rest is easy. Now, as far as Obama, I'm sure there was hundreds, maybe thousands of people that made statements about doing him in. But it didn't happen, did it? Well, there had to be a reason why, because if the system and the ruling class were really that upset with Obama, it would have been done. And here again, it would have been done by a left or right-wing person who'd been radicalized and so forth. But I find it quite interesting that with all that fire and hatred towards Obama, nobody ever did it or never even tried, as far as I know. But that's... you never know about these things. But I'll guarantee you one thing, if anybody had tried or would try, the powers that be know all about it and are watching it all along and helping guide the person towards the ultimate end, because that's standard practice. Speaking about state secrets, I'm going to continue with my reading of the state secret book put out by the International Communist Anti-communist organization years ago. They've been out of business for a long time. page 86. It was always necessary to distinguish between the errors of Hitler's regime, which were repugnant to the Catholic conscience of the Spanish nation, and Germany's geographical situation in the front line of the defense of Europe against the appalling storm arising in the steppes of Asia. A call for the rectification of the equivocal doctrines of Nazism was no reason for destroying the defensive strength of Germany, considered as a front line of resistance against the deadly invasion from Asia. And for that reason, it was essential to save Germany from the risk of annihilation. To put it briefly, if Nazism was a decidedly abominable idea for a diplomat, Germany represented a European reality which had to be taken into consideration. The American ambassador, for his collaborators, nevertheless continued to work for the improvement in relations between Spain and the United States. After the correspondence terminated, they had little illusion that they would succeed in changing the opinion of Count Jordana and the Spanish government. In December, the Tehran Conference took place, and two men, Stalin and Roosevelt, whom Churchill attempted in vain to oppose, deposed of the fate of the whole world without being subject to any control whatsoever, and freely shuffled the cards determining the future of the non-communist countries and the lot of their inhabitants. Quote, "We know now," unquote, Senior Dazognagnu wrote, "that for military reasons, Eisenhower and the American government opposed Churchill's plan, envisioned a landing in the Balkans. If Churchill's plan had been accepted, the history of these latter years would not have been quite so filled with tears and horror. In general, the strictly military outlook concentrates its efforts on solving the problems immediately at hand. Thus, it sacrifices the future, or, which comes back to the same thing, it prepares new problems, which are sometimes even more grave than they would have been had they not been foreseen and stifled before taking shape." In other words, the military doesn't look over the heads of people out what's going to happen when they do things. Their whole thing is to solve a problem that's right in front of them, without considering the problems in the future that it brings up. The real statesman is the man who can stand up in a high observation post and command the long view. If you abandon criteria of policy during the struggle, you close your eyes to the morrow. It now remains to bring this chapter of Spanish history to its conclusion. Roosevelt's secret letter to Zabrowski, publisher in Senor Dosanyuk's book, is an extremely important document, and it seems quite extraordinary that such a document reproduced in a book of an official character, which had been written by a diplomat who was formerly Count Jordana's secretary and placed publicly on sale in Madrid. It seems extraordinary. I maintain that this document should have remained practically unknown outside Spain. As far as I am aware, it has only been mentioned in the French newspaper some years ago, but the journalist who wrote the article about it does not seem to have understood its importance, and its publication produced practically no reaction at all. The United States Embassy, when consulted about the document, was manifestly extremely embarrassed and delayed a long time before finally sending a brief note in reply saying that the State Department had found no trace of the letter in its archives. And this is why I continue to tell you the most dangerous part of this government of the United States is the State Department. It is where most of the crap is bred in this country, both internationally and nationally. And so if you want to solve a problem in this country, there either has to be an elimination of the State Department or a totally redoing. And I doubt whether Trump would in any way possibly have the guts to do that. I'm sure if he did, it would mean his ultimate demise. Quite apart from the inherent prudence of all diplomatic service, this reply really carries no significance since it is a question of a personal and secret exchange of correspondence between President Roosevelt and Mr. Dabrowski, Jewish. His intermediary was Stalin. The Spanish government has not divulged its source, nor in its place would any other government have done so. All we know is that it was a feminine personality in the immediate circle around Roosevelt who secretly communicated the document to the Spanish government. Good woman. The Spanish government was absolutely certain of its authenticity since their policy and speeches of their rulers had been profoundly influenced by it. Furthermore, it is an undeniable fact that the agreements reached at Tehran and Yalta were in conformity with the lines indicated in this famous letter. I have personally questioned the author of the book, Signor Dasniaghu, who granted me an interview when he was ambassador at Rome. Naturally, he did not reveal any diplomatic secrets, but he made the following very judicious remarks. The authenticity of the document is apparently merely from its context. Carry yourself back to the time which it deals. Who was there among us, unless it were some prophet who would have been accused of being out of this mind? Who could have imagined in advance that Roosevelt, acting as his personal capacity, was about to hand over half of Europe and Asia to the Soviets, secretly and without gaining anything in return? Finally, a certain number of conclusions may be drawn from this document. One, there have been attempts to excuse Roosevelt on the score that at Yalta he was a dying man, unable to defend himself in the conduct of the negotiations. The letter to Dabrowski, on the contrary, proves that the Yalta agreement had been prepared far in advance by a secret understanding between Roosevelt and Stalin. Two, it was Jews who served as the intermediaries between Roosevelt and Stalin, confirming the enormous influence which Jewish advisors of his immediate circle exerted over Roosevelt and their communist tendency. Well, of course, Harry Dexter White, I believe it was living in the White House, and he was a communist. He was exposed after the war. Jewish circles, therefore, bear a heavy responsibility for the disastrous Treaty of Yalta and for the seizures made by the Soviets in Europe and Asia. Just think of this, of the total horror that was inflicted on the people of Eastern Europe because of this crap. This does not relieve Roosevelt in any way of his personal responsibility, his lack of awareness of what he was doing, and his failure to comprehend Stalin's communism remain utterly amazing. There are only two possible explanations for his attitude. Either he was truly ignorant to an astonishing degree for a politician who was so astute, or he was a conscious agent of subversion entirely dominated by the Jewish influences around him. I agree with the latter. In either event, his presence at the head of the American government and latter's omnipotence at a crucial moment in history represented a very grave danger which threatened the future of the whole world, and in particular of Western civilization. Color them white. America, which was so blind to reality, and today Count Giordano's predictions have indeed come true. For many years now, America has been engaged in a cold war with Russian and Chinese communism, and maintains a gigantic strength of naval, military, and air defenses, which are kept in a state of permanent alert in readiness for an outbreak of war. I think that was a total construct of the military-industrial complex, not only of Russia and China, but the United States. They were able to drain billions out of their population and here in America based on that fear. And it was all set up. It was all set up. For many years now, America has been, oh, wait a minute. She has replaced Germany as an unholy alliance with pagan Japan. She waged a costly war against the Chinese communism in Korea, and in Southeast Asia is still conducting a bloody struggle against the Viet Cong, who are supported by Russia and China communism, which she is far from winning, not to mention Cuba, South America, Africa, and other hot spots throughout the globe. And these did not need to happen at all. All these so-called wars were a construct of the military-industrial complex and the ruling class. There was no need for 55 million people to die in Vietnam, or 55,000? Anyhow, a lot of Americans. And, of course, they died all over the place fighting so-called communism, which we really never defeated in totality. Because you can't win something like that. You're going to lose from the very beginning. It's a setup. Tell the young kids around you, don't go into the military. Go into technology or something, but stay out of the goddamn military. As time goes on and the light of history becomes clearer, we can reaffirm with greater certitude, yes, Spain was right. But who wanted to listen to Spain? They wanted to listen to the Jews. The tragic events in Czechoslovakia have focused attention anew on the Yalta Agreement. The United States have been accused of doing nothing to oppose the invasion of Czechoslovakia by Russian tanks, because this country came under the zone of influence attributed to the Russians in Europe by the Yalta Agreement. The U.S. could have gone right in there and cleaned it up. But they had a deal with Uncle Joe. In reply to this charge, the United States Special Envoy in Paris, Mr. Avril Harriman, and I remember him, who was leading negotiations with Vietnam, recently stated with great firmness that no division of the world into zones of influence took place at Yalta. Just think of the millions of Vietnamese that died in Vietnam, the Vietnam War, plus Americans. It's unbelievable. Now people go over there on vacation. If I was Vietnamese and experienced what happened to me during that time, I would slit the throat of every person that came to visit. I would be at least feeling like it. Dropping napalm on them, Agent Orange on them. It was all uncalled for. The Zambrowski document, which we have published, shows that at least in Roosevelt's mind, such a division took place. But the Zambrowski letter is a secret document whose authenticity can only be proved by the Spanish government, although it is true that Count Jordana, who was then Spanish foreign minister, had no doubt whatever as to its validity. However, when my Freemasonry and the Vatican, in which an English version of Dombrowski's letter was published for the first time, was launched in London in the spring of 1968, I held a press conference in which I was approached by an American member of the audience who told me that the document is unquestionably authentic, since confirmation of it may be found in the memoirs of Cardinal Spellman. Researching this clue, I found that there is, in fact, a long passage in these memoirs which constitutes an implicit and very strikingly confirmation of this famous document. On 2nd September 1943, the Cardinal, who was then Archbishop Spellman, dined at the White House with President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, and on the following morning he had a long conversation lasting an hour and a half entirely alone with the president, in which he wrote down at once in his memoirs. In it, the cardinal resumes Roosevelt's thoughts as he had expounded them in the course of the interview, and here they are as related to Reverend R.I. Gannon, S.G., in the Cardinal Spellman story. Quote, "It is planned to make an agreement among the Big Four. Accordingly, the world will be divided into spheres of influence. China gets the Far East, U.S. the Pacific, Britain, Russia, Europe, and Africa. But as Britain has predominantly colonial interests, it might be assumed that Russia will predominate in Europe. Although Chiang Kai-shek will be called in on great decisions concerning Europe, it is understood that he will not have any influence on them. The same thing might become true, although to a lesser degree, for the U.S. He hoped, although it might be wishful thinking, that the Russian intervention in Europe would not be too harsh." Oh, jeez. League of Nations, the last one, was no success because the small states were allowed to intervene. The future League will consist only of the Big Four powers, U.S., Britain, Russia, and China. The small states In reply to this charge, the special envoy in Paris. Wait a minute, what have I got the wrong one? No. In reply to this charge, the United States special envoy in Paris, Mr. Averill Harriman, who was leading negotiations with Vietnam, recently stated that with great firmness that no division of the world into zones of influence took place at Yalta, which is a lie. The Zabrowski document, which we have published, shows that, at least in Roosevelt's mind, such a division took place. But the Zabrowski letter is a secret document whose authenticity can only be proved by the Spanish government, although it is true that Count Jordana, who was then Spanish foreign minister, had no doubt whatever as to the validity. I hope you understand why I'm reading all this to you, because nothing changes. I mean, people change, leaders change, but the system and the conspiracies never change. They just keep reinventing themselves. And the common working man runs out there to fight on one side or another. However, when my Freemasonry and the Vatican, in which an English version of the Dabrowski letter was published for the first time, was launched at London. Wait a minute. I think I read this before. The Yugoslavs and the French asked to be co-signers. We simply turned them down. They have no right to sit in where the big ones are. Only the Russians were admitted because they are big, strong, and simply impose themselves. Russia, an interview with Stalin will be forced as soon as possible. He believes that he will be better fitted to come to an understanding with Stalin than Churchill. Churchill is too idealistic. He is a realist. So is Stalin. Therefore, an understanding between them on a realistic basis is probable. The wish is, although it seems improbable, to get from Stalin a pledge not to extend Russian territory beyond a certain line. He would certainly receive Finland, the Baltic states, and eastern half of Poland, Bessarabia. There is no point to oppose these desires of Stalin because he has the power to get them anyhow. So better give them gracefully. See how they play with people's lives, all these small countries and the big countries. You're nothing but pawns. Furthermore, the population of eastern Poland wants to become Russian. I doubt that. Still, it's obviously not sure whether Stalin will be satisfied with these boundaries. Just think, Patton wanted to go right on to Moscow. On the remark that, and of course, Patton was probably murdered, on the remark that Russia has appointed governments of communistic character for Germany, Austria, and other countries which can make a communist regime there, so that the Russians might not even need to come, he agreed that this is to be expected. Asked further whether the Allies would not do something from their side which might offset this move in giving encouragement to the better elements, just as Russia encourages the communists, he declared that no such move was contemplated. It is therefore probable that the communist regimes would expand. But what can we do about it? Well, did you want to do anything about it? France might eventually escape if it has a government of a la Léon Blum. The Front Populaire would be so advanced that eventually the communists might accept it. On the direct question, and you see why France has been so weak for so long? It all started way back there. And Britain was not unhappy to see France be weak. That's gone on for hundreds of years. Keep Europe weak. And it looks like if the common market crashes, that Europe is going to split up and nationalism will return to these countries, more like tribalism, which would be better than going along with the Jewish common market, or EU. On the direct question whether Austria, Hungary, and Croatia will fall under some sort of Russian protectorate, the answer was clearly yes. But he added, we should not overlook the magnificent economic achievements of Russia. Bullshit. Their finances are sound. Well, we gave them tons of gold. It is natural that the European countries will have to undergo tremendous changes in order to adapt to Russia. But he hopes that in 10 or 20 years, the European influences would bring the Russians to become less barbarian. I don't think the average Russian was a barbarian. Be it as it may, he added that the U.S. and Britain cannot fight the Russians. The Russian production is so big. The American except for trucks is negligible. He hopes. Thanks Henry Ford for that. Henry Ford, the great anti-Jew, anti-communist, went over there to Russia and built all those truck factories, which came back to bite Hitler in the ass with trucks and tanks in the Second World War. So you can thank good old Henry Ford for that. He hopes that out of the forced friendship may soon come a real lasting friendship. The European people will simply have to endure the Russian domination in the hope that in 10 or 20 years they will be able to live well with the Russians. Finally, he hopes the Russians will get 40% of the capitalist regime. The capitalists will retain only 60% of their own system, and so an understanding will be possible. This is the opinion of Litvinov. Well, they would have been much better to get along together had not hundreds of millions of people, Europeans, Russians, and Europeans died because of this invasion of Russia. There was a very good possibility of not only Germany but the other countries blending in and working with Russia, and communism would fade away. So they blew that by Hitler invading Russia. I know all my right-wing people out there, the Hitler lovers, are going to not be too happy with that. But that's the truth. Austria. No plan for Austrian government in exile is made or tolerated. There will be no opposition to a Russian-dominated communist Austrian regime. And one thing that would save Austria from the communists would be if Otto of Austria succeeded to gain that throne with the help of Hungary. But even then, he would have to deal with the Russians. Well, one thing you got to know about Russia, Russia never invaded a strong country. Russia always, or the Soviets, only invaded small, weak countries. Of course, everybody says they were poised to attack Germany, which is bullshit because that's not the way they operated. Germany. An agreement has been reached before Roosevelt and Churchill that Germany will be divided into several states. It will have no more central government, but will be under the domination of the Big Four, mostly Russia. There will be no peace treaty, but simply a decree of the Big Four. And there still isn't a peace treaty with Germany. Before that, hearings would be held, but these would have no influence. Germany would be divided into the following states: Bavaria, Rhineland, Saxony, Hesse, Prussia. Württemberg would become a part of Bavaria. Saxony would take parts of Prussia. Hanover would become an independent state. Germany would be disarmed for 40 years. No air force, no civilian aviation. No German would be authorized to learn flying. Poland. Poland, if reestablished, would get eastern Prussia. Other countries, plebiscites would be held in the following countries: France, Italy, Netherlands, Belgium, Norway, Greece. No plebiscite is to be expected in Czechoslovakia. How far this type of realism reflected the thinking of Roosevelt's favorite bishop can be gathered from the deep concern voiced at this time by the American hierarchy on the increasing influence of Soviet Russia in the distribution of the spoils of war. Its members agreed that secularism, exploitation, and totalitarianism, whether fascist, Nazi, or communist, would never lead to a lasting peace. While Archbishop Spellman himself was urging everywhere that we keep the spirit of revenge out of our activities and win the war without destroying the victory. That's not the way it's done, Archbishop. You're living in a dream world. I don't believe that most Catholic or any of these other preachers down deep at their heart believe that either. While the Archbishop was still a guest in the White House, word came that Montgomery had slipped two divisions across the Straits of Messina, and the Allied invasion of the continent was at last an accomplished fact. The joy of the news with its implications of approaching victory was tempered for many by the increasing danger of the Holy Father's situation, unquote. By this time, however, the writer's sincere devotion to the president was already troubled by doubts. The more he thought about the policy of unconditional surrender and discussed it with the military authorities of the highest rank, the more impossible it was for him to accept it. He could see that it was not only stiffen German resistance and cost both sides innumerable casualties. Well, who cares about that? But it made everything the Pope and he himself had been praying for seem so futile. The Holy Father's favorite phrase, repeated again and again, had been peace with justice. There is a leaning towards the Catholic Church in this periodical. I think that they're playing that the Catholic Church wanted peace too much. The Catholic Church is not noted for peace. Check history out. But what armed forces had ever been just an utterly prostrate foe? To complicate matters, the second conference at Quebec had been held in September. There, the plan of Secretary Morgenthau to annihilate the German people by dismembering their country and giving pieces of flesh to all the neighbors by wrecking all the mines and factories and condemning 70 million human beings to live off a piece of land that would not feed half of them. A plan characterized by Secretary Hull as one of blind vengeance, and been accepted by Churchill and Roosevelt almost without reservation. And Morgenthau's a goddamn Jew. I mean, how many crimes do the Jews have to commit before they pay the price? It'll probably happen again if the world's going to go anywhere. A hierarchy of the Jews. On the same day that Hull had received the president's memo embracing the Morgenthau plan, he received another informing him that Morgenthau had been presented at Quebec in conjunction with the plan for Germany, a proposal of credits to Britain in the amount of $6.5 billion. The Secretary of State wrote later, quote, "This might suggest to some a quid pro quo with which the Secretary of Treasury was able to get Mr. Churchill's adherence to this cataclysmic plan for Germany. You see, all these Aryan white people are going along with this mass murder to the Germans after the war. This whole development at Quebec, I believe, angered me as much as anything that had happened during my career as Secretary of State." On Roosevelt's return to Washington, Hull found that he did not seem to realize the devastating nature of the memorandum of of the 15th of September, to which he had put his okay, FDR. Later in the month, Secretary Stimson had a talk with the president from which he drew the same conclusion. Quote, "He informed me," said Hull, "that he had thereupon read to President several sentences from the president's memorandum of the 15th of September, concluding with the phrase, looking forward to converting Germany into a country primarily agricultural and pastoral in its character." Again, the Jews. Stimson informed me that the president was frankly staggered at hearing these sentences and said that he had no idea how he could have initialed the memorandum, and he had evidently done so without much thought, because he's a goddamn liar. That's why Roosevelt was a liar. This ominous change that was coming over the president was not lost on the observant archbishop. I brought back to his mind snatches of the conversation that had disturbed him during the past year and many of his friendly visits together. He could recall the disarming smile with which Roosevelt would say, "The Pope is too worried about communism," and the rich tones of his voice as he expressed his sympathy with the great Soviet democracy, Russia. Democracy. Stalin's Russia. Oh, boy. I submit at the time most of the people in the White House were quasi-communists. "Russia," he said one evening when they were sitting around after dinner in the White House, "has need of protection. She has been invaded twice, you know. That is why we shall give her part of Poland and recompense Poland with a part of Germany." Jeez. The archbishop protested, "But your decision cannot cause a part of Poland to become Russia except by driving the population off their land. It is immoral to uproot people like that and take away their homes and their churches and even their cemeteries." "Don't worry about it, kid. We're going to do it anyhow." He remembered especially the interview the week before the president left for his conference with Stalin and Churchill at Tehran. It had shocked him profoundly that Roosevelt would not go much more than halfway to meet the Red Dictator in his own backyard. And he told him so. Nor was he reconciled when his old friend answered with a smile, "Don't worry. I know how to talk to Stalin. He's just another practical man who wants peace and prosperity. The Archbishop answered, he is not just another anything. He is different. You can't trust him. He'll never cooperate. Worried as he often was, however, he would conclude that despite occasional signs of irresponsibility coupled with loose social and political planning, FDR was still a genius, a very charming genius, and able to end the horrors of the World War. Shut up. What is this crap? And in closing this chapter, after a few months, however, as details of the things that were done in Yalta gradually seeped through to the American people, the Archbishop's old doubts and fears began to grow into genuine disillusionment. The climax came when His Excellency learned that his one-time ideal had handed over to the Soviet Union not only southern Sukhalin, but also the Kuril Islands, too, for it stirred the memory of the certain evening at the White House just after his return from Alaska. It was a painfully vivid memory. Roosevelt had been summing up for his guest the events in the Pacific Theater and pointing to a map on the wall that showed the Kuril Islands, saying dramatically, "These islands are a dagger aimed at the heart of America. They must never fall into the hands of the enemy." The Archbishop realized with a sinking feeling that the dagger was now in the hands of our most dangerous enemy, and that was a sick president unwillingly put it there. And that's the end of that chapter. So goes it over and over and over. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow. And I hope you understand the overriding reason I'm reading this. So we quit falling into the same traps over and over again. Let the right wing fall, you know. Let the Let the chaos factor continue. It's working very well. And if Trump gets out of line, and he will, the chaos factor will gobble him up. And it's gobbling up on both sides. It's working quite well. The news media is on the ropes. The Democrat Party is on the ropes. The Republicans are riding high, but they'll find a way to screw themselves up. Wait and see. I'll be back tomorrow. This is Terrible Tommy back in the bunker. Back in the bunker.
Swallow us all.
Chaos.